This is the Daily Signal podcast for Tuesday, May 7th. I'm your host, Rob Bluey. Victor Davis Hanson is well known for his intelligent commentary and astute analysis of current events, which we are proud to feature on the Daily Signal. But for his latest book, he tackles a topic related to his work on military history. It's called The End of Everything: How Wars Descend into Annihilation. Hanson studied four historical examples of wartime extinction that he features in the book. Then he applies those lessons to contemporary society to examine our own vulnerabilities. The book is on sale today, and Hanson spoke with the Daily Signal to share his observations, along with some advice about what's at stake for the United States. Stay tuned for our interview right after this.
For over 35 years, the Heritage Foundation Job Bank has been helping conservatives at all professional levels find employment in key positions in Washington, D.C. and across the country. We can help you connect with positions in the administration, on Capitol Hill, in public policy organizations, and in the private sector. To learn more about the Heritage Foundation Job Bank, go to heritage.org/job-bank.
We are joined on the Daily Signal today by Victor Davis Hanson, a best-selling author, columnist, and scholar and historian at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Dr. Hanson, we're honored to have you back on the Daily Signal podcast today to talk about your new book, The End of Everything: How Wars Descend into Annihilation. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, let's start by sharing with our listeners your motivation for doing this book. Very interesting topic, kind of in the realm of the events that are playing out in the world today. But from a historian, what motivated you to write it?
Well, I was wondering, I've written a lot of books on military history, and I've come across cases where the defeated didn't just become occupied or surrender unconditionally or have change of governments or suffer grievous losses, but they were completely wiped out. And by that, I mean, it wasn't just their physical space, their populations. Of course, in the ancient world, they enslaved anybody they didn't kill. But their language, their culture, their civilization, their religion disappeared within a generation. And so for today, we don't know much about Punic culture in North Africa or the Aztecs in Mexico. And did that happen frequently? It didn't happen frequently, but what were the conditions under which it occurred? And then I have a long epilogue trying to speculate if that could still happen, given that the agents of annihilation, nuclear, biochemical, AI, are much easier to use than muscular labor of the past.
Well, that's certainly true. And let's come back to that final point in just a moment. But, yes. But before we get there, can you talk about the four different case studies that you examine of wartime extinction in the book?
Well, in 335, Alexander the Great, who had just become king on the assassination of his father, Philip II, marched 300 miles southward into occupied Greece. The Macedonians were occupied because Thebes, which at that time was the most iconic city of the 1500 city-states, rebelled. And they thought the new king would either be killed, or he had claimants to the throne, or he was inexperienced, and what could a 21-year-old do anyway? And he besieged the city, and then after 3 days of warning, they thought that the seven-gated Thebes was legendary for its bastions. He broke into the city. He killed everybody in battle that he could, 6,000. He enslaved probably 20,000, and he demolished the city down to the foundation, saving only the house of Pindar the poet. And that was the end of Thebes as a distinct subset of Hellenic culture. About 200 years later, the Romans had had enough after a century of fighting the Carthaginians. They had won the First and Second Punic War, but they'd always come to terms with them. And so after the second one, they gave them a fine, indemnity payments, occupation. They had certain protocols, all of which the Carthaginians met. But they sent a delegation to see what was going on, and they were shocked that there were 500,000 people in the city. It was wealthier than ever, and it was on the rebound a third time. So The elder Cato, famous for saying Carthage must be destroyed, Carthago Delenda est after every speech. They sent a huge consular army of about 70,000 people right across the Mediterranean at its narrowest point to modern-day Tunisia, Tunis. And after 2 years, they couldn't do much because the walls were the largest in the ancient world at that time, 21 miles. They'd never been broached. But they had a literal genius among the ranks, a lowly officer, a legate named Scipio Aemilianus, the adopted grandson of the famous Africanus who beat Hannibal. And within about 3 months, he had occupied the city, broke through the walls, had killed probably about 450,000 people, enslaved the 50,000, destroyed the walls all the way down to the foundation, plowed the ground, wiped out all of the satellite villages or forced the ones that were still to survive a great tax. And that was the end of Punic culture, Punic religion, Punic script, Punic government. And within about 50 years, there was no one in North Africa that knew much about this 800-year civilization. And of course, Rome founded a new Carthage about 15 miles away, which is the foundation you can see if you go to Tunisia. And then I tried to look at a different example much later, 1453, Tuesday, May 29th, 1453. Constantinople fell to the Ottomans under the Sultan Mehmet II. He had a huge army of 200,000 people below the walls. But like Carthage, the land walls of Constantinople had never been breached, and they're almost impenetrable if you look at them. The problem was the city was in decline. It had been there for 1,100 years. It was the center of Greek, Christian, Hellenic culture in Asia. At one time, the Byzantine Empire was 20 million people. And they had repulsed all the attacks for 2 months. They didn't think they could break through. Kind of a chance accident with some of their Italian help allies. One was wounded, Giustiniani, and people panicked. They broke through the walls, and the rest is history. And that was the end of Byzantine culture in Asia Minor that had been there, as I said, before Byzantium, actually. It had been there for, Greek culture had been there for 3,000 years. And within 30 years, all of the Byzantine satellite towns were ethnically cleansed. The Ottomans took over the greatest cathedral in Christendom, Santa Sophia, made it into a mosque. It's now a mosque again. And there was really no Christian Hellenic civilization left. And there isn't really today either. And then finally, I looked at Hernan Cortez's storming of what is now Mexico City, the Aztec city of Tenochtitlan. It was also impenetrable. It was like a Venice on a lake, empire of 4 million people. And he destroyed it within 2 years, never with more than 1,500 conquistadors. He razed the city to the ground or burned it, the parts that were flammable, enslaved the survivors, turned loose the allies of Cortez that were very angry that they had been subjects of human sacrifice, 20 or 30,000 a year the Aztecs sacrificed from their subjects, and they wiped out most of those who were not enslaved. And there was no more central Aztec civilization. There were fragments that in some mountain villages today in Mexico, there's some people who speak Nahuatl. It's a descendant of that language, but for all practical purposes, the Spanish wiped it out in 2 years.
That's an outstanding history lesson. Thank you so much for walking us through those four examples. So it raises the question then, which you talked about earlier, in what ways are we today in contemporary society vulnerable to the threat of extinction?
Well, I try to look at a pattern, if there was a pattern, and I also mention a few other examples, the island of Milos, for example, as well, in passing. But in all these cases, these societies did not realize they were in decline. They did not realize that in the past, when they had wars, there were usually negotiations over the victor, between the victor and the defeated. And they had no idea who Cortez was, who Scipio was, who Mehmet II was, or Alexander, that these were killers and they were different sorts than they had encountered before. They also had this kind of naive, egocentric idea that allies would come to their rescue. The Spartans will come and save us. The Venetians will come to Constantinople. The Macedonians will attack the Romans from the rear. And they didn't really understand that all allies are self-interested. And then finally, they didn't understand that these killers, destroyers, were not like Genghis Khan or Tamerlane. They were men of education. Alexander was tutored by Aristotle. Scipio Aemilianus had Polybius at his side, the great Roman historian, when he destroyed the city. Mehmed had the largest library in the Islamic world. Cortez was a man of letters. And so they didn't realize that they had thought deeply about how to destroy that. They didn't just come in, kill, rape women, and leave. They really had an existential plan to erase these cities. And when you look at today, there's the same idea that no one would ever do that. It couldn't happen here. This is in the past. So I went through in the epilogue and looked at all the threats of extinction that we have seen in, the last 15 years. I was shocked. It wasn't just Kim Jong-un saying that he wanted to wipe out South Korea, and he would. But it was people like Erdogan, the Recep Tayyip Erdogan. He has threatened, he said not too long ago, about 8 months ago, that the Athenians, the modern Athenians, would wake up one morning and there would be a barrage of rockets to wipe them out. That was anger over his attempt to take back islands that are Greek off the coast of Turkey. He said to the Armenians, and we've just at Nagorno, at Karabakh, a year ago, they ethnically cleansed every Armenian out of Azerbaijan, and they had been there for 1,000 years. And he said, we're going to deal with Armenia itself in the way that our grandfathers did. And that was, of course, the destruction of Armenian culture in Turkey. We know what the Iranians have said. There was a very controversial statement by Rafsanjani about 20 years ago, but more that's been reiterated lately that in a variety of contexts, that the idea of Israel as the home of devout Jews is actually a gift to Iran because it concentrates devout Jews in one place. Half the world's Jewry is now in Israel, but more importantly, these are the observant Jews. And they are at what Rafsanjani called a one-bomb state, that one nuclear weapon could erase Jewish civilization itself. Putin, of course, says that Ukraine is an aberration. It doesn't really exist. It was a province of the Soviet Union, and the language should be obliterated. It should be reincorporated into Russia. And I've counted about 16 statements in the press that Russian generals, Russian media, or Russian government officials have said if the war were to continue, they would use nuclear weapons. In the case of China, they have threatened to wipe out Taiwan and destroy the bastard idea of a Taiwanese civilization. They say it doesn't exist. They've threatened to nuke as well Japan if it aids Taiwan. I only mention that because I've had pretty good luck with Chinese publishers buying books on military history. I wrote a book on World War II they purchased, but they sent a letter to my publisher at Basic and basically said if I didn't take that sentence out of the book, then they were going to cancel the publication agreement. And of course, I couldn't take it out. Instead, I sent back not just one threat of Taiwan, I found about 15 others. And I said, this is ridiculous. You've done this more than... And so they've canceled the Chinese translation. But it's pretty prevalent. And also the denial. You know, people on the walls of Constantinople said, we can work with a sultan. He won't kill everybody. And people said, Alexander the Great is a philosopher. He won't obliterate us like Philip did Olynthus or something like that. And when you see the same denial, people get very angry when you mentioned Putin's threats. They said, oh, he's just bluster. He would never do that. And Kim Jong-un would never do that. And I'm not sure that's true. History says that the odds are they won't, but it's happened. And there's no second chances when that happens.
We're talking to Victor Davis Hanson, author of the new book, The End of Everything, How Wars Descend into Annihilation. And on that last point, I certainly agree with you. It seems in many respects so unrealistic, but yet you have documented just for us here now the many leaders across the globe who are making these types of threats. You mentioned earlier in the interview the role of AI, artificial intelligence. What role do you think technology is playing in either facilitating or even exasperating the potential for these actors to destroy, you know, other societies?
I think we learned with COVID gain-of-function research that the technology was accelerating much more rapidly than the social, political, economic, cultural analysis of how to handle it. And there were people who were freelancing, like Echo Health, for example, that was giving expertise to the Wuhan lab. I think the same thing is true of AI. Unfortunately, I work at Stanford right next to Silicon Valley. So when I go out and eat dinner at night, I often listen to conversations of techies, and I know people who give to Stanford, et cetera. I have very little confidence on their moral sense. I have a great deal of confidence that they're very adept in high-tech research like AI. So my point is that when we see things like the FBI hiring Twitter contractors to suppress news about a laptop in the last election, these are the same people, the same mentalities that will be in charge of AI. And there was, I mentioned in the book, a Pentagon simulation in which they used a computer launch completely directed by an AI program. And so they sent a missile on a computer and they programmed every defense mechanism in it possible. So as it went into the computer, they launched computer simulations of air attacks from aircraft, from anti-ballistic missile systems, weather problems, etc. And then when it was almost over, they had the computer kill the launch because it was over. Well, the launch didn't kill. It turned around and went back at the launch person because it had been programmed to think spontaneously about a threat. So the person who launched the missile had never thought that the missile would attack him. And so they shut down the entire experiment because they realized that they didn't have the capability in the real world of ensuring that an AI couldn't reason or analyze a threat, including the person who launched the missile, which would be the greatest threat of all if he canceled the missile and aborted it. So things like that are pretty scary, just like the COVID and biochemical, et cetera. And I think if you look at what these people said in the past, I was just shocked about the denial. Montezuma said, you know, we're going to be here forever. He had visions that the Cortez were some type of deities maybe, but he thought he could appease them. And the same thing was true of the Carthaginians. They said, you know what, we will give up our elephant. We'll do everything. The Romans won't do this. And they had no intention of doing anything else other than destroying them. So I do think there's people like the Chinese Communist government, like the government in South Korea, like the government in Turkey, like the government in Iran, who are in a whole different moral universe than what we think they're in.
So do you think that some of that denial exists here in the United States today?
Absolutely. I don't think the average American understands that the Chinese are producing 4 ships per year to our 1 ship, or that if you took any of our $15 billion carriers and you put them in the straits between Taiwan and China, they wouldn't last more than an hour, given the Chinese have developed missile batteries where they could launch 5,000 or 6,000 small missiles that would go about 6 inches above the water and hit the water line at night. And you couldn't stop that. They are building nuclear weapons at a phenomenal rate. They're working on anti-missile defense. They have somewhere between, they're back up to probably 250,000 students in the United States. If 1% are engaged in espionage, and the FBI said it's more than that, you've got thousands of people who are appropriating technology. I don't think anybody understands that it's going to take us 6 years to replenish javelin stocks, and maybe we can't. North Korea is producing more 155 millimeter shells than we are. At least they sent 2 million of them to the Russians. So we are not armed, and yet our strategic responsibilities, our strategic confidence, our arrogance has not lessened commiserately with our reduced defense capacity. We're 40,000 recruits short now in the military. Never happened before. And when you analyze who is not joining the military, it's not blacks, it's not Latinos, it's not gays, it's not women, it's not trans people. All of those numbers are the same. It's the largest group are white males from the lower and middle classes whose families fought in Vietnam, first Gulf War, Afghanistan, but this third and fourth generation are not joining up. And unfortunately for the military, if you look at the casualty or the fatality rates in Afghanistan and Iraq, that demographic dies at twice their demographics. 72 to 74% of all the dead in Afghanistan, in Iraq, are white males from the middle and lower classes. And yet this is the very demographic that General Milley and Lloyd Austin and testimonies have suggested suffer from white rage or white privilege. And the Pentagon was investigating just those kind of slanders about that demographic. And they found, of course, in December, they quietly issued a report. There was no cabal of white supremacists. But the point is, you can't really have a successful military when you're 40,000 recruits short in just a year.
You're absolutely right on that point, and thank you for raising it. One of the things that I appreciate most about your work, and we're honored to publish your weekly column at the Daily Signal and encourage our listeners and everyone else who's viewing this to check it out. It's a phenomenal column, and you are one of our most popular columnists because of the topics that you tackle and the historical perspective that you bring. So in light of the book, what do you suggest that societies today, including the United States, learn from those historical examples you gave us earlier in the interview to maybe mitigate some of the risks that that we might find ourselves in the future?
Well, I would not put much confidence in international bodies or even in so-called close allies. The Spartans came all the way up to the Thebans and they heard the Macedonians, they turned right back. On the last day of the existence of Constantinople, they were looking out at the walls at the Hellespont thinking that Venetian galleys en masse would come up and save them. So I support NATO. I don't really think the UN is of much value. The only thing that will save the United States is a deterrent military, and we don't have that now. An overwhelmingly large, successful, smart military. And if we don't have that, we're going to see more of what we saw in Afghanistan, what we saw with the Chinese balloon, what we see in Gaza. And I think Americans don't realize that we're on the back of a tiger and we can't get off because we set up the post-war world and we had the pretensions of saying to the world, you can go in the Red Sea, you can go in the Black Sea, you can go in the Strait of Hormuz, you can do all that and you won't be injured. That was a wonderful thing to do. But if you're going to have those pretensions that you're going to have a post-war order, you have to have a military that from time to time takes care of the Houthis or gets rid of Soleimani. And doesn't mean you're going to be a neocon interventionist, but I think under Trump and Pompeo, they had a, I guess you would call it a Jacksonian idea that there would be no better friend than the United States and no worse enemy. And we did not want to get involved in optional military adventures, but we would be very, very tough on our enemies. And then the tougher we were, the less we would have to do it once we reestablished deterrence. So we've lost deterrence, and that can be achieved militarily, economically, politically, but we've lost it in every category. And it's going to be very, very dangerous to reestablish it.
Thank you for that answer, sir. You recently had the opportunity to speak with Heritage Foundation President Kevin Roberts in California about a variety of topics. And I'd just like to close on this point. How much is at stake and what is at stake this year in 2024 as it pertains to the future of this great country of ours?
Well, everybody says each election is, you know, the most important. But I can tell you that this election is more important than 2016 and 2020, because we have never, in my lifetime, we've never seen a Democrat. The Democratic Party, they always say the Republican Party was taken over MAGA, but you look at 90% of the MAGA agenda, and it's traditionally low taxes, small government, strong defense, closed borders. But the Democratic Party, as we're seeing with Columbia and all these student protests, they are a revolutionary party. They do. It's not that they believe in a porous border. They believe in no border. It's not that they believe in light sentencing. They don't want to sentence anybody. They don't want to have bail. They don't believe that there is such a thing as deterrence, the way we got out of Afghanistan. They believe in radical climate change. If you can show them data, you can show them all sorts. They don't care. They want to ban combustible engine. They don't want fossil. So this is a group of people, as we're seeing in this split screen with Donald Trump charged with this ridiculous misdemeanors bootstrapped onto felonies. At the same time, people are entering with violence into a Columbia building, and as one of them said the other night, they will be out in 24 hours. I don't think they're even in jail as we speak. They're already out. So I guess what I'm saying is we're in a revolutionary Jacobin period, kind of a reign of terror, and I don't see it stopping unless, I don't think the election of Donald Trump will be enough. You'll have to elect the Senate, Donald Trump, and enlarge the House majority. And then they're going to have to act very quickly to stop it, to restore the border, to restore deterrence against criminals, to get back our preeminent position economically, to stop this $1 trillion borrowing every 100 days. We're in bad shape, and so in every category. And I think whether we like it, I know there's a lot of never Trumpers out there, but whatever problem they have with Trump's temperament, it just pales in comparison with the ideological revolutionaries that are in there now and want to. If Biden is reelected, what we saw the first term will be nothing. It'll be enhanced to a magnitude. It'll be so much greater. So I'm really worried about this election, especially the integrity of the balloting and turnout and all of those other issues.
Well, we appreciate that perspective, and there are several reasons to be concerned, which is one of the reasons why we appreciate people like you for bringing it to our attention and making sure that we're focused on the right challenges. And thank you for spending time with the Daily Signal today. Again, we've been talking to Victor Davis Hanson. He's the author of the brand new book called The End of Everything, How Wars Descend into Annihilation. You can find it wherever books are sold or online. And make sure you check out his weekly column with the Daily Signal. Thank you so much, sir, for visiting with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And that'll do it for today's episode. Thank you for listening to the Daily Signal podcast. Be sure to check out our evening show right here in this podcast feed. We help you cut through the clutter and bring you the top news at 5 p.m. each day. Also, please subscribe to the Daily Signal wherever you prefer to listen to podcasts. And help us reach more listeners by leaving a 5-star rating and review. We appreciate your feedback. Thanks again for listening. Make it a great day or not, the choice is yours.
The Daily Signal podcast is made possible because of listeners like you. Executive producers are Rob Bluey and Kate Trinko. Hosts are Virginia Allen, Brian Gottstein, Mary Margaret Olihan, and Tyler O'Neill. Sound design by Lauren Evans, Mark Guiney, and John Pop. To learn more or support our work, please visit dailysignal.com.